Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. We engage in the study of the Hebrew Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context and original languages to promote good and reasonable interpretation of Scripture so that the church might live more faithfully in the present. Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney. And I have Dr. Nathan French with me today for a special new kind of episode that we're going to do. Dr. French presented a research paper at an academic conference recently, and we thought we want to share that with everyone. Everyone in our audience, we thought you'd love to give it a taste of just, you know, the even more refined research that comes through writing articles, writing books. And this would be a great experience because it'll take about 20 to 25 minutes for him to read the article, which is plenty within our normal podcast episode length. And so basically, Nathan's going to introduce the article a little bit, then he'll read the article, and then we'll both maybe discuss some thoughts we have just kind of extemporaneously from his written article. So I'm really excited for this one. This will be a lot of fun.
It will be. I'm excited too. It'll be nice to be able to present this. Yes, I presented this first time I presented it. It's actually right out of my published dissertation. So it's an article that I've created out of basically the last chapter of my dissertation, focusing in on a particular theme from that chapter that that I wasn't able to just highlight in the book itself. So taking research out of a published book and creating it into an article because it sort of strips away the other elements of that chapter itself. Presented this, I think, at a regional SBL meeting, and then most recently at SPS, the Society for Pentecostal Studies. So I'm not going to present it again. So I thought this is the perfect place to do it, right? We'll just present it here on Hebrew Bible Insight. So I'm really looking forward to it.
That's excellent. Yeah, this will be a lot of fun. Real briefly, I'll just say, I think it's so cool that this paper originated as an element of your published dissertation that you just knew you wanted to follow the rabbit trail further, not only in how it was related to your specific dissertation. I think that's such the nature of research, right? You know, you have your plot you're following, but inevitably you get into so many other things that you can't. You can't dig into everything because it's a little off center from what you're trying to do at first.
That's right.
But then you get time to come and revisit it in it through a different lens and a different focus.
Yeah.
So that'd be really cool.
Exactly.
Okay. Any other thoughts before we just dive in?
Just for our listeners, especially if you're on YouTube, we have slides going at the same time. So the slides are going to follow the paper. And I'll move through the slides as I come to the place in the paper to move to the next slide to help with information. Otherwise, I'll just be reading from beginning to end. So I'm ready to go when we are ready.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and dive in. And Hebrew Bible Insights audience, here is a research paper by the Dr. Nathan French.
All right, this paper is entitled Uriah, Bathsheba, and Solomon, Divine Retribution in the Throne Succession Narrative. Common to historiographical texts in the ancient Near East is the structuring element known as the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution. A. Malamat suggests that this principle worked its way into Hebrew historiography through the Anatolian Hittites. However, Daniel Bodie, in his most recent article on the topic, disagrees, stating, "The view of history as the outworking of a retributive principle is common to all the major cultures of the Mediterranean seashore." In light of this structuring element of historical graphical texts in the ancient Near East, known as the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution, I contend that we consider again the so-called throne succession narrative, 2 Samuel 9-20 and 1 Kings 1-2, and its legal situation revealed through the acts of the Lord's retribution. Central to the TSN is a literary juxtaposition of the Hebrew lexings tov and ra'ah, or resh ein, lexemes whose permutations serve to function at times in the TSN as the narratival markers of the Lord's blessing and curse. Thus, in the paper to follow, I will seek to uncover the legal situation that the TSN addresses and the motivation of the Lord's retribution by following a nominal permutation of Resh Ein Ein, namely Ra'ah, evil slash misfortune, through the entirety of the narrative. In so doing, I will show how the law of the leveret motivates the Lord's retribution, which works toward the provision of a name in Israel for Uriah the Hittite. In my concluding thoughts, I will consider the etymological meaning of the name Shlomo in order to confirm this present thesis. David's Crimes Against a Resident Alien, Section 1.2. In 2 Samuel 11, David commits a series of crimes against Uriah the Hittite, whose status in the Davidic monarchy could be interpreted as a resident alien or a ger toshav. For Daniel Bodie, Uriah's status as a ger in David's monarchy is similar to the same status of the ubarim, an Akkadian term denoting a special class of people widely attested in texts dating from the early 2nd millennium to the middle of the 1st millennium BCE. The Akkadian term ubarim typically refers to a class of people that can best be defined as a, and I quote, stranger, foreign guest, resident alien, or guest friend, end quote. Indecent treatment and mockery of this class of people was considered a breach of international law in the ancient Near East, which could have been met with punitive action. This common practice of hospitality is well known and attested through legislated protections for the gerim of the Hebrew Bible in Covenant Code and in Deuteronomy. According to the text of 2 Samuel 11, David first neglects and scorns the resident alien, Uriah the Hittite, by taking his wife, Bathsheba, who soon finds that she has conceived and carries David's child. The most reasonable conclusion concerning Bathsheba's complicity in her sexual union with David is to suggest that she had nobody to whom she could cry for defense in the act itself. Thus, Bathsheba is presented by the TSN as a character unable to protect herself against the sexual aggression of the tribal chieftain David. The narrative's silence in condemning Bathsheba in the crime of adultery may have echoes to common ancient Near Eastern laws pertaining to family relations and sexual behavior. In the Hebrew Bible, Deuteronomy 22:25-27 also relinquishes any responsibility on the part of the woman if the act takes place in an open field where no one can hear a woman's cry for help. In verse 27, the man who committed the crime is to be put to death. Deuteronomy's legal principle for said penalty is clear in these passages, wherein the woman is the victim and not complicit in the crime. Thus, David committed adultery by taking another man's wife as his own. So Deuteronomy 5:18. The second egregious act committed by David against Uriah is none other than subsequently having him, Uriah, murdered by the sword of the Ammonites in order to hide his original taking. The sort of societal problem that David created in his final egregious act in Israel is often missed or even ignored. Uriah the Hittite, the only named minority in the text, having been murdered by David, was left without progeny in the earth. Without intervention, his name would be blotted out of Israel. So see, for example, Deuteronomy 25:6, which represented the worst sort of curse that could come upon a man in the ancient Near East. Due to Uriah's lack of progeny, Bathsheba is now required to enter into a leveret marriage in order to bear a son on behalf of her deceased husband, Uriah. However, 2 Samuel 12:9a alpha indicates a serious roadblock to this end set down by David, which is spoken of by Nathan the prophet on behalf of the Lord, Ve'et ishto lekachta lecha le'isha, which reads, "And you have taken his wife to be your wife." Due to David's murder of Uriah and the taking of his wife, making her his own, there now remains nobody to bear a child on behalf of the deceased husband. In other words, Bathsheba is, according to rabbinic jurisprudence, a gunot, tied to an absent husband. yet now married to King David, the one who murdered Uriah, her husband. According to Talmudic and rabbinic tradition, this sort of legal situation, that is, the one in which a woman was left tied to an absent husband, was counteracted by having soldiers and warriors write their wives a conditional divorce letter called a get piturin in the event that they did not return from battle. It was believed by later Jewish tradition that this practice was first carried out in ancient Israel during the time of Saul and David. Rashi, in his medieval Midrashic comment upon 2 Samuel 11:15, states, "And he will," and I quote, "and he will be struck and killed in order for Bathsheba to be divorced from Uriah retroactively. The result would be that David did not cohabit with a married woman, because all soldiers who went out to war wrote a conditional divorce document for their wife should they die in battle," end quote. Bodhi makes a compelling argument that this Talmudic and rabbinic interpretation is similar to the widow's tablet mentioned in a Middle Assyrian law, 4571, from the 15th to the 13th century BCE, which concerns a POW's wife receiving a widow's tablet from a soldier who does not return. To be clear, no such tablet is mentioned in 2 Samuel 11 to 12 narrative. However, it is interesting that this ancient Near Eastern legal principle regarding a widow as tied to her absent husband, a husband who has no progeny in the earth, is already the central motif of the court narrative. It is no wonder that Rashi came to the conclusion that he did. If David knew of such a tablet, then upon Uriah's death, Bathsheba was retroactively divorced, and David was free to marry her, as she was not obligated to perform the levirate and bear a son on behalf of Uriah. This is clearly confirmed in 12:9a alpha, wherein the Lord calls David to account by accusing him of first striking Uriah down with the sword, Uriah hachiti hikita vachelev, followed by an accusation of taking another man's wife as his own, ve'etishto lekachta lecha le'isha, thus representing the Lord's rejection of any potential get piturim or divorce certificate. In other words, the narrative is clear in the Lord's accusation against David that Bathsheba is still Uriah's wife. She is tied to an absent husband. This makes good sense as we consider the curse and the punishment that is declared against David by the Lord via Nathan the prophet. By the end of 2 Samuel 11, the narrator tells us that this thing that David did was evil in the eyes of the Lord. Vayirah hadavar asher asa David b'nei Adonai in 11:27. In the following episode of 2 Samuel 12, Nathan the prophet emphatically declares to David in 12:11a alpha, Ko amar Adonai, hineni makim alecha ra'ah mibatecha. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will bring upon you misfortune slash evil, that is, ra'ah, from your own house. Notice the wordplay in the narrative. David does ra'ah in the eyes of the Lord, to which the Lord responds in kind by declaring a curse through the prophetic oracle of Nathan that will bring ra'ah upon him from his own household, mi batecha. This is qualified by the text in 12:11 even further, in that the punishment of ra'ah will be of the same quality and measure that David used against Uriah the Hittite. In light of this passage, and precisely because this historiographical work is structured according to the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution, so Bodhi, I will now analyze every nominal permutation of ra'ah that occurs within the throne succession narrative in order to determine upon what sort of legal principle the narrative is founded. Though there are many troubles that come upon David in the TSN, this paper will only ask this particular question. How does ra'ah come upon David in the ensuing narrative? Divine Retribution in the TSN, section 1.3. In 2 Samuel 12, 18, the first permutation of Resh Ein Ein after Nathan's prophetic indictment is employed. I suggest that this occurrence of Ra'ah is significant on a narratival level. The narrative's aforementioned result of the Lord's curse is that the child would die, i.e. 2 Samuel 12, 13 to 14b, and that the reasoning for his death is due to the transference of David's sin, as stated in verse 13. Be that as it may, I contend that the appearance of Ra'ah in 2 Samuel 12, 18 brings to remembrance the prophetic oracle of Nathan in 12, 11, in that David's servants express concern that he might harm them, or probably more reasonable to the context, that he might harm himself in kind to the hearing of the news of the death of his child. In light of the structuring element of this narrative, we, the readers, must ask, is this the harm or misfortune, that is, the Ra'ah from the Lord that comes upon David from his own household? Mi batecha. We learn that David will, in fact, not bring harm upon himself. After the death of the child, David comforts his newly acquired wife, Bathsheba, and she bears a son whom he names Solomon, Shlomo, verse 24, and in 12:24b, the text reads, "The Adonai Ahavo," and Yahweh loved him, which is certainly a statement of faithfulness to come. Section 1.3.2, David's son Amnon, 2 Samuel 13 to 16. The second occurrence of Ra'ah in the narrative appears in Amnon's evil act against his sister Tamar in 2 Samuel 13. Important to note is the writer's use of the verb inah, to oppress, to humiliate, or to press down, that appears in verse 12 to describe the rape of Tamar by Amnon. Ellen Van Vold contends that the use of this verb denotes more than the modern understanding of rape. She convincingly argues that this verb in this context, although referring to an act of sexual abuse against Tamar by Amnon, is used by the writer as a juridical term to warn Amnon of the sort of crime that he would be committing against Tamar, against himself, and against the entire society as a whole. The appearance of Hara HaGedolah in Tamar's speech of 13:16, after the act of Inah has been committed, reveals that the Ra'ah committed by Amnon was both his initial and his subsequent act against her, namely his crime against her, himself, and the society as a whole, and his act of causing her out of, and his act of casting her out of his presence. Be that as it may, on a narrative level, this occurrence of Ra'ah in verse 16 is indication of 1, the crime committed by Amnon, Hara'ah HaGedolah, in 13:16, and 2, it suggests the divine curse meted out upon David for his crimes against Uriah, Hineni Makim Alecha, Ra'ah Mi Batecha, 12:11, as this particular event will lead to Amnon's untimely death. More to my original point, it is the retributive principle working itself out in the TSN's structure of this historiographical tale. Interestingly, after learning of this egregious act, David refused to call his own son, Amnon, to account. The reading of the MT in 1321 differs from the Septuagint and the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Septuagint is translated in the second part of the verse as, "And he did not grieve the spirit of Amnon, his son, because he loved him, because he was his firstborn son." This exact phrase appears also in the fragments of 4Q Sam A, 13:21. Velo etzat et ruach Amnon beno ki ahavo ki bechoro hu. It is important to note that both the translators of the Septuagint and the scribe of 4Q Sam A 13:21 have a written tradition that indicates a variant in this particular narrative. Although the MT's version is the shorter reading, the Septuagint and the Dead Sea Scrolls suggest that some ancient readers understood 13:21 to have a thematic element focused upon David's unwillingness to use his judicial authority against his own son. In other words, David refuses to call his son Amnon to account as tribal chieftain for the egregious act he committed against Tamar. In any case, both the MT and these two variant readings agree that Amnon was not punished by his father David. In David's absence as judge, Amnon's act of Ra'ah is met with equal retribution brought forth by the sword of Absalom, verses 28 to 29, Amnon's half-brother. Amnon's death at the hands of Absalom in 1328 was a direct result of Amnon's act of Ra'ah against Tamar. In accordance with the retributive principle as a structuring element in the TSN, Ra'ah has come forth from David's own household, culminating in the death of David's son Amnon, his beloved firstborn son, while also resulting in the exile of Absalom, David's next son, to the throne. Section 1.3.3, David's son Absalom, 2 Samuel 15, 14, 16, 8, 17, 14, 18, 32, and 19, 8. In 2 Samuel 15, Absalom, David's son, who is the next in line to David's throne, begins his attempt at usurping his father in order to assume the kingship in Jerusalem. The retribution of the Lord stemming from David's house through his son Absalom is seen here by following the word Ra'ah through several chapters concerned with Absalom's coup d'etat. The first occurrence of this word in these chapters appears in 2 Samuel 15, 14. David, as one under the divine curse, has, within the narrative, an inclination of what to expect as the result of Absalom's uprising against him. Thus, 2 Samuel 15, 14 can be read as the continuance of the accomplishment of Nathan's prophetic oracle against David, which is evidenced by the narrative's contrast of Cheriv, sword, with Ra'ah, disaster. Such a contrast leads the reader back to the Lord's curse against David through Nathan's indictment in 2 Samuel 12:10a and 12:11a alpha. Ve'ata lo tasur cherev mebetecha ad olam, and then ko amar Adonai hineni makim alecha ra'ah mebetecha. So then, in 2 Samuel 15:14, the retributive principle is seen through the Hebrew noun ra'ah that emanates from Absalom. As interpreted by David to be in the realm of possibility, thus David's exile from Jerusalem begins. The next occurrence of Ra'ah in the Absalom episode is in 16:8, and it is found in the mouth of Shimeah at the moment of David's ascending of the Mount of Olives in his exile from Jerusalem. David is perceived as being under the divine curse because of his expulsion from the throne in the attempted coup of his son Absalom. Shimeah, a descendant of Saul, recognizes the situation as a Ra'ah and calls attention to the reason that he thinks David is indeed under the curse, namely, to his, David's, blood guilt committed against the house of Saul. According to the TSN, the kingdom had not passed into the hand of Absalom on account of David's actions against the house of Saul, but on account of his actions against the house of Uriah, for example, 2 Samuel 12:10-14. As Anne-Marie Kitt states, and I quote, "Eventually, one learns that Shimeah's curse fell utterly flat, that he was never acting under the Lord's directive as David had feared," end quote. I disagree with Kitts. In the narrative, Shimeah's recognition of the curse was correct. However, his assumed reason for the curse was incorrect. Regardless of Shimeah's interpretation, David's experience of Ra'ah is evidence enough of the Lord's curse as presented within the TSN. One of the most telling occurrences of Ra'ah is found in 2 Samuel 17, 14. Here, Absalom is at the most crucial point of his attempted coup. What is clearly stated in the text is that the Lord's decree will result in Ra'ah for Absalom because the Lord is determined to bring Ra'ah upon him. Havi Adonai el Avshalom et Ra'ah. This suggestion is further corroborated by the messenger Cushai in 1832 and by Joab's statement in 19:8, wherein he names the death of Absalom as a disaster, ra'ah, that has befallen David. Furthermore, Joab was the one who, in defiance to David, killed Absalom with three spears, a subtle but interesting narratival reversal of Joab's obedience to David in placing Uriah at the front of the battle. Notice the similarity between 2 Samuel 17:14b beta and Nathan's oracle in 2 Samuel 12:11a alpha. Vi Adonai el Avshalom et ra'ah, ko amar Adonai hineni makim alecha ra'ah mi batecha. In this way, 2 Samuel 17:14, along with 18:32 and 19:8, contains the textual marker ra'ah in relation to Absalom's death and demise, a deep and heavy misfortune for David, as seen in his response to learning of his son's demise in 2 Samuel 19, and I quote, "O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son," end quote. Section 1.3.3.1, David's son Adonijah, 1 Kings 1:52. Now we come to Adonijah, the last of David's sons who remains as potential successor to the throne within the narrative. Both Nathan and Bathsheba make it clear in 1 Kings 1:12 and 21 that the lives of Bathsheba and Solomon are in danger if Adonijah succeeds David on the throne. Thus, at the end of the TSN, and after Solomon ascends the throne by the word of David, Solomon assures Adonijah of his safety with conditions in 1 Kings 1:52, stating that as long as Ra'ah is not found within him, he will live. And so it is that in 1 Kings 2:23 to 24, Adonijah is executed by Solomon for his request of Abishag the Shunammite as wife, implying that indeed Solomon did perceive Adonijah's request for the kingship to be an act of ra'ah worthy of his life. The execution of Adonijah, David's remaining heir to the throne in the TSN, means that Solomon, the son born to David through his marriage to Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, has been fully established on the throne in Jerusalem. What is of highest concern for my argument is to acknowledge this occurrence of ra'ah, the final appearance of this word in the TSN, as reason for Adonijah's death, which suggests the continued curse of the Lord meted out upon David through Nathan's oracle in 1211, Mi Batecha. Section 1.4, concluding thoughts. Let us now consider the fullness of the crime committed by David against Uriah in this episode, in conclusion to having analyzed the retributive actions of the Lord in the TSN. I contend that in 2 Samuel 12-19 and 1 Kings 1-2 narratives, David's lineage of potential successors to the throne are eliminated by the Lord's curse, save for Solomon, the son born to David through his marriage to Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. It is David's three sons, Amnon, Absalom, and Adonijah, who lose all rights to be his successor, making way for the Lord's choice of Solomon. Thus, David's crime is a crime committed against Uriah and Bathsheba and the progeny of that marriage to carry on Uriah's name in Israel. Several commentators have proposed the idea that Uriah the Hittite was possibly the next in line or the already pre-Davidic monarch to the Jebusite throne in Jerusalem. On this suggestion, Nicholas Wyatt postulates that the sexual union between David and Bathsheba could be understood as a hieros gamos at which Solomon becomes the heir to the once Jebusite, now turned Davidic throne through his mother. I find Wyatt's suggestion thought-provoking, but unsure to its validity within the TSN and in the Hebrew Bible more generally. Contrary to hieros gamos, Larry Like suggests that the mashal of the wise woman of Tekoa in 2 Samuel 14, whose central concern was the extermination of her husband's name from Israel in consequence to fratricide, contains, and I quote, themes, vocabulary, and imagery, end quote, that has strong resonances with Deuteronomy 25, 1-12, the central text of Leveret in ancient Israel. Be that as it may, I suggest that the allusion of the Leveret is more evident within the narrative itself. First, the initial act of David's crime was the taking of another man's wife. It is interesting that the leveret is a reversal of David's crime. That is to say, in the event that a deceased man's potential progeny is in jeopardy of being blotted out from Israel, it is lawful, out of obligation for the deceased brother and the widow, for the next of kin to take another man's wife as one's own in order to provide an heir so that the name of the deceased not be blotted out of Israel. Second, one cannot negate the monarchical legitimacy at play in this narrative, and indeed the institution of leveret has had implications for dynastic claims in other parts of the ancient Near East. Third, as reflected in the literary narratives of Genesis 38 and Ruth, the legal principle of the leveret deviates drastically from that which is found in Deuteronomy 25. Lastly, it must be noted that Solomon is the firstborn of a sexual union within the marriage between David and Bathsheba, but not the firstborn of the marriage per se. Only after the marriage between David and Bathsheba does the covenantal language of the Lord's love for the issue of the marriage, Solomon, appear in the TSN, indicating that he will be David's successor by divine choosing. Thus, the significance of the marriage between David and Bathsheba is rooted not in the sacred marriage rites of the ancient Near East, but within its legal tradition, as demonstrated in this paper. Finally, the narrative movement helps to explain the meaning of the name Shlomo. Some scholars contend that the name Shlomo is derived from its PL stem, Shilem, to make restitution, to compensate, to reward. Thus, Shlomo would mean, and I quote, his replacement or his substitute, end quote. J. Stamm is the first to contend that the name is part of a group of names that generally refer to replacement names, so Anderson, for a lost sibling or parent, so McCarter. His contention is that Solomon is the replacement for the first lost child and named so by the characters in the narrative. T. Viola disagrees with Stamm and Gerelman, contending that the death of the first child is a later addition, and that the name Shlomo, his replacement or substitute, refers to Uriah and not to the deceased child. Within this framework, the name Shlomo would be a narrative indication referring either to the death of the first child born through their illicit union or to the deceased husband of Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittite. Clearly, ambiguity exists within the larger narrative itself. However, I see no reason as to why the death of the first child must be considered an addition in order to perceive an allusion to Uriah the Hittite in the name Shlomo. Both suggestions could be held in tension together. On one level, the human characters are naming the child to mean his substitute as consolation for the death of the first child. Yet on another level, the naming of the first child, the marriage between David and Bathsheba, that is Shlomo, provides uncanny allusion to Uriah the Hittite, who was left without progeny in Israel. In light of the name Shlomo as meaning his replacement and partly referring to Uriah the Hittite, I suggest once again that the legal principle of the leveret comes to the fore, albeit within a rather obtuse historical situation in narrative retelling. It could also be argued, so Esbar Efrat and Bodhi, that David's assimilation of Bathsheba into his house after the death of her husband is indication of his, David's, and I quote, prerogative to provide for the widow and the orphan, end quote, as the tribal chieftain. Thus, as C. Davis and others have already proposed, Solomon is, and I quote, more truly the child of Uriah than of David, end quote. This suggestion, however, is in tension with the genealogical list of 2 Samuel 5, 13 to 16, 1 Chronicles 3, 5 to 9, and 1 Chronicles 14, 3 to 7, which have Solomon as the fourth, that is, the last born to David through Bathsheba in Jerusalem. However, these names are most likely not listed in birth order. That being said, the TSN presents Solomon as the firstborn of the marriage in 2 Samuel 12 and 1 Kings 1, but not of the union. Therefore, I contend that the central tension of the TSN is that of the Lord's promise to David and his dynasty, that is 2 Samuel 7, 28, Hatova Hazot, to have a son sitting upon David's throne forever, and that of the Lord remaining true to his actions of retributive justice on behalf of Uriah the Hittite, a Ger Toshav in David's court, who, being murdered by David, was left without progeny in Israel. The child, Solomon, and his mother, Bathsheba, hold that tension together throughout the whole of the TSN precisely because they only appear as characters at the beginning and at the end of this longer-running narrative. In light of the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution, as the structuring element of these historiographical texts in the Hebrew Bible, Solomon's ascension to the place of David's successor is presented by the TSN as the divine act of retribution. Thus, the structuring element of divine retribution in the TSN leads to the security of Solomon's succession to David, which necessitates, in the name of Shlomo, the remembrance of Uriah the Hittite. And that ends the paper right there.
Wow, this was amazing. I absolutely love getting to hear you present this again. And just brilliant research. This is...
Thank you.
I mean, just, gosh, there's so much we can talk about here with this. Mm-hmm. But I think just generally speaking, again, if we get to do things like this in the future, this just gives people a taste of the more refined, deeper content that comes from the depth of academic research.
That's right.
So,
When you read a text closely, there's just so much. And when you sit with a text for a year doing heavy research on it, it's just amazing what comes out of the text. As you know, with the research you've done yourself on multiple texts, it's just amazing what can come out. So,
quick shameless plug while you're talking about that, actually. If any of you want to read scripture with us, we would love for you to join the Hebrew Bible Book Club. You can find a link in the description below. Our Patreon community gets together every month just to read text together and just read the text and talk about it. Obviously, we're not writing academic articles within, you know, one session, but it's just really fun to get a lot of people reading scripture together and discussing. But let's talk about let's unpack some of this research for a little bit. There's so much you addressed, and I think this is an episode that some people will love to re-listen to and really open up their Bible, go through and check these things out. The first thing that comes to my mind is I feel like so much of what you've done, it really makes sense of the flow of the narrative of David, that these scenes are there, they really do flow together and they're connected. In fact, I remember talking to a pastor friend of mine who really didn't understand why there's a scene with one of David's daughters being raped by one of his sons. It's just like, why is this here? Like, why put this story in the Bible? And if we only, you know, I think we've all heard about taking lines out of context, right? But theoretically, you could do the same with scenes, or maybe not even taking them out of context, but just not understanding how and why they fit. And so I wonder if you can just, obviously your research, you know, you did that really thoroughly in the academic, but maybe you can just talk extemporaneously a bit about how what you're doing, it really helps show how the puzzle pieces fit together from the moment with Uriah the Hittite.
No, it's really good. And I mean, I've heard it in popular preaching. It's a lot, it's said a lot. Oh, well, David made a horrible mistake. He committed adultery. And it's like, okay, you're just going to leave it there. No, he murdered, he took a man's wife against her will, according to the narrative, and he murdered a man. So it's far worse than even just saying, I think committing adultery, obviously, as I presented the paper. But furthermore, what the Hebrew text and what the ancient authors are getting at, and that's what I think Ellen Van Volde really brought out in her research on Inah, as sort of this pressing down of Tamar, shows that what David did to Bathsheba and Uriah has such wide implications for the whole community of Israel in that moment. It's not just this individual thing that's happening, but it's just so much wider than that. And then the just retribution that comes forth against David by the ancient authors. Now, again, they're just interpreting... they're interpreting what's happening on the ground, right? So it's history and the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution that is being interpreted. So that is, it's the hermeneutic that the text is highlighting with regard to the historical events as they happened, right? So this is what happened, and the laying down of the narrative and the structure by the writer, that's where the hermeneutic comes in. And it shows, I mean, right there with Amnon, I mean, that's a hard text. And I think what's interesting there too, is that it never says, of course, that the retribution, the very thing that Amnon did to his sister Tamar, is brought forth from the Lord. But it is that Ra'ah appears there. So we get the sense that this is somehow related to the curse that was against David. And in ancient Near Eastern curses, it's interesting because, and Anne-Marie Kitts, her book on this is fantastic. Cursed are you, exclamation mark, right? And I had to have that looking at me during my whole PhD dissertation, right, on my bookshelf. It's a fantastic book. I know I've talked about it before. And she just covers curses in Akkadian and Hebrew texts. And she's such a brilliant scholar. And the tome that she's written there is such a blessing, right, to have. no pun intended here, right? Such a blessing to have, actually, because the work just lays it out. But she really shows in that work that once a curse is given from the divine realm in the ancient Near East, it takes on a life of its own. So it's not like it's controlled. It just has a force that moves through the community, and who knows where it's going to go. Because, you know, in the Tamar situation, there's no really mention of the Lord's hand in it, but you do get the prophecy from Nathan in chapter 12 that the Lord is going to take the wives, David's wives, and give them to his companion or his friend, i.e. to Absalom, and that David did the thing that he did to Bathsheba in secret, but the Lord's going to do it in the eyes of everyone. And so you have that piece that I didn't mention because Ra'ah doesn't come up in that particular part of the narrative. But what you ultimately see is the retribution principle, and that the Lord is going to bring forth justice for this poor family, Uriah, and for Bathsheba, and the family that isn't going to be now because of what David did. And he's going to bring that forth. Now, what's really interesting, I think, ultimately on that point that you bring up, is that this all comes right after 2 Samuel 7, where David is promised an eternal dynasty. And suddenly, we're just two chapters from that. And then suddenly we're at chapter 11, 7 to 11. But the throne succession narrative often thought to begin in 2 Samuel 9. And so here we are at 11, and suddenly the Lord has to decide, does he keep this promise to David? And he's going to keep the promise to David because that's who he is. He keeps his promises. But he's also going to bring forth justice on behalf of Uriah. And suddenly we have to step back, as you and I have talked, as the Lord is the father to Israel, because Israel is his firstborn son. So now the Lord has to bring forth justice for his children and work it out. And you can tell that David knows that this is what's happening. And I think David's trying to save the lives of all of his sons, because he knows that the curse is somehow coming out in that direction. You see it with Absalom. He puts Absalom in exile, and then all of a sudden, Absalom wants to come back, and David doesn't know what to do. He's like, well, I feel like I want to leave you in exile because I don't want anything to happen to you, but is convinced by that ruse of the woman from Tekoa and Joab to bring him back. And by bringing Absalom back, that pretty much solidifies what the Lord's going to do to him in 2 Samuel 7 and bringing him down in his coup d'etat against David. But it destroys David. Like, David does not want that to happen. And so it's like we're torn between, here's a father who won't punish his son for what he did, Amnon, as tribal chieftain and judge, but he was willing to murder Uriah and destroy another family for no crimes at all, for his own crimes, you know.
And interestingly, also, he won't do it even to Shimei, someone who's not even a family member, yeah. Someone who his men are like, hey, look, we can put his head in a platter for you right quick. You know, this guy who's insulting you to your face publicly.
And with Shimei, it's really interesting too, because in that interpretation, and this is where the hermeneutic fits. So the characters are interpreting everything according to the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution as well. Yeah. You can see it there. Shimei is wrong for the reason. It's not because of what he did to Saul, but because of what he did to Uriah. So
So interesting. Okay, I wonder if there's a parallel. You were talking about this fascinating tension between 2 Samuel 7 with this eternal covenant to have a descendant of David on the throne.
Yeah.
But also almost immediately following a few chapters, this deal with Uriah and the retribution that must come for that. I'm curious, do you see any parallel in the narrative of Exodus where you have, like, say, Exodus 19, this idea that you will be a nation of priests and the people that I've chosen. And then, of course, the spiritual infidelity that ensues not many chapters after
that
ceremony. And even that Moses and the Lord have a conversation together
where
God's thinking about choosing a different people, you know, wiping them out, starting over with Moses. Do you see any kind of similar, like, tension dynamic with the covenant people in that?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of it's evident in Jewish tradition and rabbinic interpretation. It's also evident in the scholarship as well on Exodus. There are a lot of questions about. I think ancient Christian tradition has this as well. Catholic interpretation will go this direction too. That the Lord is responding to Israel, that there are plans that he has, and that in reaction to the spiritual infidelity that's committed with the worship of the calf, the golden calf, and the idolatry that ensues, that out of that comes obviously some have suggested out of that comes the holiness code of in Leviticus and some other responses to it, actually, so that it's an interesting idea that the Lord is reacting to how the humans are behaving, and it's not as if you have just this one off. This is what was planned all along, but in response to how Israel acts, this is what you get. And I think you see the faithfulness of the Lord within Exodus, where it seems that he wants the people to come up the mountain. They're terrified. They pull back. And so what, on a narrative level, what I find interesting there is that the Lord is on the mountain. He wants them to come up to him. They are too scared. So at the end of the narrative, what do we have? We have a tent in which the Lord lives with his people. We had the tent of meeting before that, right? So you have that sort of interesting comparison happening there. I had a student who brought this up at an Exodus class recently, and I thought, oh, that's great, because the Lord's like, okay, they're scared to come to me. Now we got to find a way that I come to them and dwell in their midst, you know? And so I think that that's a nice sort of way to look at that. And I'm sure it's part of the plan. I mean, I had to say that there's different plans, but you could say it's part of the plan all along, because he knows the beginning from the end. But nonetheless, I think how David reacts in repentance, and it's the repentance piece of David that is often, it's highlighted in popular preaching, but with the adultery piece, it's like, okay, God forgave him and he moved on. But David barely makes it. Like, on his deathbed, it seems that Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet have to still convince him that you promised that Solomon would be the next in line. And he goes through with it, and he makes that decision. So we know that David remains true to what he thinks the Lord wants. But it's hard for David after that moment. Samuel tradition really brings him to that point. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's so important. So many of our David stories is, you know, the young shepherd boy who is overlooked, yet anointed, killed the giant, you know, honored God's anointed, even when it was King Saul who was trying to kill him, and eventually does become king and is someone who, quote, has a heart, after God, which, of course, that's a whole other conversation another time. But but anyway, and he had this terrible incident with Uriah the Hittite and with Bathsheba. And he sought Lord's forgiveness. And then we almost just jump to Solomon.
Yeah.
And right. I think for many people, that is what we know of David.
Yeah.
And not realizing there are many more chapters of his life. And they don't present him in a good light. And you see the destruction that happens around him.
Yeah.
And I think we feel even in the tone of how he talks, for example, the way he talks to his men about Shimei, I think is that dialogue is very representative of the way that he talks about Absalom, the way he talks about his kids. I don't want to do over psychoanalysis here. I haven't thought about it enough to know the exact words to describe him, but this is not the bold boy fighting the giant. This is not the same type of person.
And realizing,
there's just so much of his character. And then of course you have toward the end of Samuel also with the important narrative about the census that happens and a lot of people who die based on on that event too. So this might be like too big picture for today, but I think that the theme of the hope figure in the Hebrew Bible that I think starts as early as Cain, where, you know, we know the seed woman will crush serpent's head. Next story, son is born. It's Cain. I think reading between the lines is Eve expecting Cain to go kill that serpent. Instead kills the brother. I think you have so many times where you have a hope figure presented. And even when there are positive elements, even like with someone like Noah, these stories, when you read in full, it's not just this happily ever after ending that happens. You know, when you have Noah with the, you know, the drunken curse and his sons with the, you know, whatever misconduct happened. So it makes you wonder with David, the narrative, like 2 Samuel 7, the covenant, it's still, that's still true, but also you're almost just left like with absolute clarity that David is not the Messiah, the hope figure that this story is looking for, if it's a way of looking at it.
No, that's a good way of looking at it. And I think in you saying all of that, sort of laying that out, and I love that idea with Cain. I think there's a paper in there. What you have ultimately in this work of theology, right? Because that's what the writer's doing here, laying down this history. There's a theological hermeneutic happening here, which is true of all history of the ancient Near East. We have an emphasis on the Lord, who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and tender mercies, right? The chesed ve'emet that we have in rabbinic tradition, and they know this. And David's crying for mercy and for repentance is what saves him in the end. And that's to be modeled for all of us in our wickedness and our sin, is the repentance of David. But the story itself, and I think that's what's so great about the 2 Samuel 9 to 20 and 1 Kings 1 to 2 narratives, this throne succession narrative, is that it's the story of two fathers who both stand in a place of great authority and judgment, both David and the Lord. And the Lord has to work out for, actually, I mean, even you could even bring the brothers into it if you think of David and Uriah in that sense too. And the Lord has to bring the judgment in the midst of that to work out the mess of what the humans have done. And it's really brilliant. So I think now some New Testament scholars might disagree with me. In fact, I know they do because I've read some works on this. But I think Matthew's gospel is quite interesting here, because it says in Matthew 1:6, and Jesse, the father of King David, and David was the father of Solomon by, and it doesn't say Bathsheba in the manuscripts, it says by the wife of Uriah. And so I think Matthew and this tradition within Second Temple Judaism is reading Second Samuel in such a way as to within the rabbinic tradition, as we saw in medieval exegesis, like with Rashi, showing that no, she still remained the wife of Uriah with an absentee husband killed in battle. And that shows here that the leverage, I think, is coming through, and that the Lord's chesed towards Uriah and all that Uriah did for Israel is to give him a name in the genealogy of the Messiah. And that's what you have, I think, here in Matthew's gospel. Remembering, though, that Shlomo is literally the biological son of David, but in leveret carries on the name of Uriah.
Which, that part was so interesting for me with your research, is digging into then what does Solomon's name mean, and how is that connected to the narrative with Shlomo, the idea of his replacement, whether it's viewed as the son who died, Uriah, or both. And I kind of like where you landed, where it's, you know, who says it's either or. Right. Why can't I plant both?
Yeah.
And so it's this interesting idea of Solomon here in this verse in Matthew. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. That although Uriah, in one sense, you could view it as, well, you know, he dies, no progeny, it's over. But really that Solomon, you know, does carry on the future for Uriah. I thought that was really, really interesting.
Yeah. And it just shows how these ancient writers really saw the Lord working in every detail of the lives of Israel and cared deeply for the people of Israel, including David, who had a terrible mess up there. So,
and I think as you've shown today, like the characters in the story through their own dialogue are showing how their own way, like Shimei, again, a good example, how he is kind of tracking with that hermeneutical principle, but from his own framework.
Right, right.
But then you have the historiography of the narrator within Samuel and Kings and the succession narrative who is applying this principle throughout.
Yeah.
I think this is yet another good example. I think people can go back and watch or listen to the episode where you present your dissertation research.
Yeah.
You know, this is another prime example. We've talked about the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution before.
Uh-huh.
This just is a really like clear layout. I think it'll help people see the intentionality and how much sense it makes of these stories because it is the framework through which this is how things are viewed. Do you have any, maybe this will be the last question. Maybe do you have any thoughts again about just generally speaking the divine principle or the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution? You know, as a framework.
Well, I really, in my research, when writing all this, stumbled upon, of course, Daniel Bode's work. And there were other works even before Bode that really highlight the fact that there's a sort of retributional principle coming out here. But Daniel Bode, from, I think he's still at the University of Paris, but his work on this point shows just how in the ancient Near East, historiographical texts are written according to this principle. And once you recognize that, you can step back and say, okay, it's still real history. It's just they're interpreting it. Daniel Bode puts it this way, according to a religious interpretation, to sort of help us moderns really understand. But on a deeper framework, I personally, when I came to the Hebrew Bible and say, okay, so on a big macro level, we have this structure. But then it was like, oh no, I think the characters are actually doing it as well. Like the characters are interpreting it this way. And it's not, and this is the problem, I think, because in the wisdom literature, we should add this for another time, but in the wisdom literature, I hear from scholars all the time today, well, you got to stay away from that retribution stuff. The wisdom literature doesn't like that. And I'm thinking, well, but it does in many respects. I mean, even Ecclesiastes ends with, well, you better do good because everything's going to end in the Lord's judgment either way. Right. And, but even in the narratives and according to this structure, you can find many times in the Hebrew Bible where the hermeneutic is not employed. So for example, Uriah struck down by the sword of the Ammonites. So a terrible thing happens to Uriah, but we don't have a story that tells us that Uriah was a wicked, evil man. Right.
Yep.
So we actually have the story saying, no, that was David doing that. David's the evil one. So it's not like it's just a one-off when bad things happen. That is retribution.
Yeah.
But there is a hermeneutic in which there are certain events that are interpreted good or bad as divine retribution. And that's the interesting piece that needs to be unpacked, I think.
That is so helpful because the oversimplification and generalization and mass application of the hermeneutical principle of divine retribution, that is, you know, what it's just so unfortunate that for some people, that's how it's viewed. It's just every single time that something good happens to somebody, it's because they did something good in the eyes of the deity or in terms of your Bible, in the terms of the Lord. And every single time that something bad happens to somebody, it's because they did something bad in the eyes of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's just you know, there's no nuance whatsoever. There's no other things going on. And so anyway, I'm really glad you put it that way.
Good.
Okay. Do you have any last thoughts, you know, about this episode, this, you know, you present in your paper and this research?
I'll say this, it's research and it's a thesis and I put it out there, right? So there's going to be scholars and others who would say, no, I don't see it. And I don't think that that works that way. And so that's the fun of doing research. That's why we do it. Yeah. And that's why we make these arguments, put it out there so that we can read the text better, understand the text, I think, in its historical context and try to really unpack it so that we can come to the meaning that the ancient authors want us to see.
Well, let us know your thoughts in the comments below. And we'd love to have you join one of our Hebrew Bible Book Club sessions as well. Link in the description below to our Patreon community there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's episode. And Dr. French, thank you so much for sharing this amazing research.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see all of you guys in the next episode.